Automated Creative are on a mission to reinvent advertising using artificial intelligence. We're a small team of startup folk who are really changing the way that advertising works. In the last few years, we've worked with brands like Adidas, Samsung, Diageo, Reckitt, KFC, Pernod Ricard, Bose, Unilever, GSK, Mondelez, the list goes on. And we are looking for account management talent. So if you know anyone who is kind of obsessed with creativity, ads, AI, and account management, if you could get them to email Rhoda at automatedcreative.net. That's Rhoda, R-H-O-D-A, at automatedcreative.net. And I will love you forever. On with the show. Hello, and welcome to the Shiny New Object Podcast. My name is Tom Ollerton. I'm the founder of Automated Creative, and this is a weekly podcast where marketing leaders talk about the future of the industry and help us understand what's going to come next. And every week I have the pleasure and the privilege of interviewing someone exciting and special, and this week is actually no different. I'm on a call with Sir Martin Sorrell, who is Executive Chairman and Founder at S4 Capital. Sir Martin, for anyone who's listening to this who doesn't know who you are or what you do, could you give them an overview of your career so far and what you do today?
So let me stick with the advertising and marketing industry. So I started at Saatchi's, where I was CFO for 9 years. I then left to start WPP, which where I was the CEO for 33 years. And now, not now, 3 years ago, I started S4, where I'm, as you said, executive chairman. That's it.
Fantastic. Thank you for the concise introduction. So before we get to your shiny new objects, I would like to know, in that extensive and famous, much talked about career, what has been your biggest work screw up? That kind of facepalm moment where you were just completely embarrassed, you thought, oh my God, what have I done? But in retrospect, it was the mistake that made you. And that if even if you went back...
I don't know if it was a mistake, maybe. The biggest thing I would admit to was the convertible preferred, very, very abstruse, convertible preferred financing of the Ogilvy takeover, what was described by some as the hostile became friendly takeover of Ogilvy in 1989. And hitherto with the JWT, we had used a mixture of debt and a rights issue, a one-for-one rights issue for a company 13 times our size. I think Ogilvy was about double our size or something like that. And it was $825 million, the total purchase price. And half of it we paid in debt and half through a convertible preferred. The theory behind a convertible preferred is that it converts from a preferred stock into ordinary shares. So the fixed dividend becomes an ordinary dividend. Unfortunately, after we acquired Ogilvy in 89, we had a recession in 91 too. And that led to a restructuring of the company using the banks, JP Morgan and others. We did a rescheduling of the debt. We didn't miss a payment, but we rescheduled the debt. And then a year later, because the economic recovery in 91, 92 had not been as strong as we thought it was going to be, we had to do a debt for equity swap, which in the fullness of time proved to be extremely successful. But that was probably the most gut-wrenching time, I would say.
But that doesn't actually sound like a mistake. It sounds like it worked out in the end.
No, it was a mistake. It was a mistake. I mean, because when we did the roadshow for the convertible preferred, there was a very astute investor, money manager at the Prudential, who said to me, drew me aside and said, Martin, anything you can do with a convertible preferred, you should do with ordinary stock. And he was right, because if you did the maths, what we had to do in the debt for equity swap, so we swapped debt for equity, so we diluted the shareholders even further. If we had done a straight equity issue at the time of the deal, which would have put much less debt pressure on our financing, that would have worked out, and we would have ended up probably in a better position, but not far off where we ended up after a lot of pain in 91 and 92 in the debt for equity swap.
So I'm going to ask you an additional question. So you're talking about very, very big moves here that not very many people get to make, but I'm curious to know, what is your advice to someone who's at the very start of their career. So they're not looking to acquire an ad agency, but they're just wanting to get into one or get into an advertising business. Assuming a student's smart, driven, focused, doing all the right things, what would you say to someone?
On the assumption that somebody's done, you know, learnt code and learnt Chinese, or, you know, they've left. You know, I spoke to a bunch of entrepreneurs at one of the UK's universities yesterday, and what was interesting, they were asking about what they should do, and I said immediately, I think, you know, go and spend a couple of years outside the UK, but make sure that you've learnt Chinese, and make sure you've learnt code. But in terms of, you know, I would follow my father's advice, which is completely counter to what people tell you to do nowadays. I would find, you know, an industry you enjoy, or part of our industry that you enjoy, locate or identify companies within that part of the industry or the industry that you think are good and that you would enjoy, and then win a position, take a position in those companies, and build a career, build a reputation. I don't mean a reputation where Tom Ollerton asks you to come on to one of his podcasts. I mean a reputation where clients or people in the industry, you know, notice what you've done and admire what you've done, and then build from there. That's what I would do. I would still follow the advice that my father gave me. What was it? 50 or so longer years ago, in terms of what I should do.
And have you learned Chinese and how to code?
No.
Are you
neither?
Going to?
No, well, I'm too old. You know, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And, you asked me about what the mistakes. I think the mistakes I made is not to learn Chinese and not to learn code. That doesn't mean that I don't. It's an interesting question, because I think, if you don't know them, you admire people who do know them. So you have a greater respect for, you know, what's happened, say, for example, in China, which is the second largest economy in the world and will be the largest. And lack of relationships with the US and China are going to be one of the biggest issues that the biggest issues that we have to deal with, along with climate change and DE&I and inequality and impact of globalization and everything else, and the pandemic and Brexit and everything else. But, you know, it is, you know, understanding China is critical. And then understanding, obviously, technological development. Because, you know, when you asked me about my history, and I went through those three things, I had three lives in the advertising and marketing services industry so far. The first one at Sarsis was around globalization. You know, one of the questions you asked me is what advertising books would you recommend? And I would recommend David Ogilvy's book on advertising. It's still as fresh today as was when he wrote it many, many years ago. But I'd also recommend an article by Ted Levitt, which he made into a book, actually, about the theory of globalization. You know, the consumers will consume everything the same way everywhere. That was in 1983. And I think, you know, having an understanding, Sarches was about globalization, and that's what we built there, led by the brothers. At WPP, it was about a continuation of globalization and the beginnings of tech, which started in the middle of the 1990s. And then S4 is purely about technology and growth. So it's a very different model. So, you know, I've gone through three iterations: globalization, a mixed globalization and tech, and then what I would call pure tech.
So you must be a busy man. You got emails.
No,
to send.
I have nothing to do but to sit here and talk to you.
Well, I mean,
I can't be by definition,
can't be that busy.
I can't be busy.
Well, I'll, So when you do feel overwhelmed and unfocused, I mean, you rattled off, you know, US-China relations, pandemic, yeah, Brexit.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
there is a lot of data to take in and process and make business-leading decisions on. When you do feel overwhelmed and unfocused, what do you do?
Yeah.
How do you snap out of that?
Well, it's interesting. I thought about that question. I mean, get a good night's sleep would be one of the things to do, obviously. But I think, you know, the honest answer, I think of my dad, actually. So, you know, he died in 1989. So, you know, whenever whenever he wrote me a letter when he died, well before he died, actually, about a year before he died, which I found his papers, or my mother found in his papers when he died. So whenever I'm in that sort of state of mind, and we all get in that state of mind, where, you know, there's a lot going on, I take great sort of strength and fortitude. I sometimes look at that letter, but more I just think about him.
What did it say? What was in this letter?
Oh, it was all... Well, actually, one of the things it said, I won't go into the detail because they're highly personal, but one of the things it started off by saying, it was dated... you ask the question, you're going to get the answer. It was dated March of 1988. And he died in 1989, on July the 1st, 1989. And he complained of a sort of pain in his shoulder in January of 89. And the first lines of the letter was, I have noticed a change in my condition. And so I will never know whether he misstated the letter. Was it March of 1989? Or whether he knew in March of 1988, in which case I'm extremely annoyed with him because goodness knows what we could have done. He died of cancer, but goodness knows what we could have done if we had had a more early warning. So I felt robbed. He died at 74. He was a great study of the Talmud and Shakespeare, despite having to leave school at 13. He referred to the Bible and said, you know, the Bible says good life is 70, which is 70 years. So he felt 74 was a good was a good age. I thought I was cheated. The other thing that I'll tell you about the letter was it's relevant to your question. He said there was a phrase in there about the clouds do blot out the sun. So going back to your question about what do you do when there are clouds blotting out the sun, is you just remember that the clouds pass. And so that was his advice to me in relation to that too. And he said, don't be overwhelmed because those clouds do pass.
That is a lovely analogy. So what's been the best investment of your time, energy, or money in the last 5 years that have made a...
Well, no, I wouldn't say the last 5 years. I mean, I when I looked at the question, I thought I went back. I mean, the best investment, people probably laugh when I say this, but was my 18 months at Harvard Business School. When I was 21, I went straight from school, from university in the UK. And I went straight there, which was unusual. I was part of the class that was described the most naive class that Harvard Business School has ever seen, because it was at the time of the draft. And so a lot of Americans were going straight from university to graduate school to avoid the draft. But having said that, I think that's the best investment. You said over the last 5 years, I mean, the best investment of my time and money must have been S4. So it was the decision 3 years ago after I left WPP to look at growth, to look at creating a new model in the advertising and marketing services industry, to try and disrupt the old. So there's something, you know, Amazonian or Teslan about what we're doing that sounds very grand, but, you know, that is what we are trying to do. And then having four principles around digital only, because that's where the growth is, a data-driven model that creates, produces, distributes advertising content through digital media in an iterative loop. Going to market is faster, better, cheaper, about agility, understanding the digital ecosystem and efficiency, and then finally a unitary structure. So we have, you know, one P&L, one single, so instead of a siloed competing set of organizations, which the holding companies are. So I would say over the last 5 years, probably the best investment of my time and money has been investing in S4 and trying to develop S4.
So I'd like to know about how you got to the realization that S4 was the right thing to do. So,
very simple, Tom. I was 73 years old. I haven't got a lot of time left on the earth. So I thought, where is it? I didn't want to retire and play golf or cricket or whatever, if I could play cricket. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to be in private equity. What I wanted to do was to sort of focus on something, because I think when you retire, you tend to vegetate, and so you need stuff to keep your mind active and physically active.
But what I'm really keen to know about is the how. Like, so you left WPP. You're like, right, I don't want to play golf, don't play cricket. Right,
I had some money. I invested some money into a cash shell, basically a private cash shell called S4 Capital. It stands for the four generations of Sorrells. So that's my father, myself, my kids, and my grandkids. Those are the four generations that have been here, because my grandparents came from the Ukraine, as best as we can figure out, Ukraine, Romania, and Poland. And so the answer to your question is, I put some money into a shell. I went to 10 institutions and said, would they put money in? They'd take 20%. I had 80%. And then would they underwrite the first deal that we did? And the first deal we did was Media Monks and Content Area. And that's how it happened.
Which is fantastic. But what I'm, I think I've asked the wrong question. What I want to know is what was your process to come up with the idea for the business? How you did it financially? That's interesting. You were kind of at zero at some point when you came out of WPP.
I looked at the market and I said, "Where's the growth?" It's as simple as that. I mean, I think you're going to ask me about what's the best advice, and I'll come on to what I think the best advice is from a marketing point of view. I don't think it's marketing; it's the best advice generally. But I had a very simple idea, which I had wrestled. 2016 was the best year for WPP in its 30-odd years of history. 2017 was a tough year, with the top line was flatlining. And, I was of the view, we had part of our business that was analog, part of it was digital. The digital was growing. I was too old to screw around with no growth. I can screw around with high growth, but not no growth. And, I think it's a really important point, because when a company is growing, people's attitude is totally different as to when it's struggling. The way I put it is, people look at the sky rather than look at their boots. And I think that's critically important. Everybody's demeanor in a high growth company or in a fast growth company is totally different to their demeanor when they're struggling. And I just didn't want to, at my tender age, I didn't want to struggle with that burden. What I wanted to do was to struggle with the difficulty, because when a business is growing at 50% like we are this year organically, and then on top of that, we're growing 100% because we've added deals on top of it. That's a challenge, but it's a better challenge than when it's going the other way. And it was very simple. It was nothing. You didn't have to be an Einstein to figure that one out. And it was just really focusing. Wayne Gretzky, famous ice hockey player, said you skate to where the puck is going to be, not where it is.
How many times have we seen that in an innovation deck in an agency? Yeah. Right, we've got to move on. So you mentioned, what is your best tip? I asked for a marketing tip, but you say it's bigger than that. What is it?
Yeah, I think the best tip is to have a very simple vision for what you're trying to do, and then have the structure to put it in place. I mean, that's very, very simple. It's apple pie and motherhood. But it's amazing how people, for example, I was on a call with a very successful guy a day or so ago, yesterday morning. And what he presented was so complicated. I mean, you literally had to be an Einstein to figure it out. So, what Warren Buffett always says, which is, if somebody can't explain something to him on one sheet of paper or in one sort of brief conversation, he shies away from it. Anybody, nothing is too complicated to explain. If it's too complicated to explain, it's because the person who's speaking or writing doesn't really understand what they're talking about, I think. And I really think simplicity is really the important thing. So a simple, well-articulated vision, mission, whatever you want to call it, and then implementing that. Structure is really important. Implement. You remember there was a great debate a few years ago at business schools is whether strategy was more important than structure or vice versa. And the answer is it's both, in my view. You have to have a very strong, simple objective, and you execute that as flawlessly as you can. So I think that would be the advice that I think is most important, you know, whether it's formulating what we were going to do at S4 3 years ago or whenever.
This episode of the Shiny New Object podcast is brought to you in partnership with Manifest. Whether it's live in London or streamed online to the global marketing community, you can always expect a distinctive and daring blend of fast-paced content, startup innovation pitches, and unconventional entertainment from Madfest events. You'll find me causing trouble on stage, recording live versions of this podcast, and sharing a beer with the nicest and most influential people in marketing. Check it out at www.madfestlondon.com. So we're going to move on now to your shiny new object, which
yes.
We read is called The Two Worlds of Advertising, which sounds very grand. Can you explain why that's your shiny new object?
Well, I get continuously frustrated by journalists and analysts and observers who lump together the digital world with the analog world. And what people have to understand is there are two worlds. Advertising and marketing really should be split into two. There's an analog world, which is no growth or slow growth, and there's a digital world, which is high growth and bags of opportunity. And it is a tale of two cities or a tale of two planets. And the digital planet is getting bigger by the day. It's 55% of the addressable markets that people talk about. It's about $1.8 trillion that the addressable markets that people talk about in media, in marketing services, and in trade budgets. It will be 70%. Digital will be 70% by 2024. So this is the high growth. And when you look at S4, which is a listed company, our comparators are not the holding companies. You know, they've gone down by 10, 15, 20 WPP by 25% over the last 3 years. That's one section. But you look at the tech-driven companies like our own. I think we're a royalty on the growth of the platforms. Just like Warren Buffett used to say when I was at Saatchi's, that an investment in Ogilvy or IPG was a royalty on the growth of globalization following the Ted Levitt theory. Today, what S4 and indeed Globant and others are a royalty on the growth of the digital transformation economy, the digital marketing economy. It's on the platforms, on the hardware companies, and on the software companies. And you know, when the metaverse becomes an even more important thing than it is at the moment, or when virtual reality becomes even more important, or when the Unreal Engine technology, which underpins Epic's Fortnite games, becomes even more important, as it's becoming. But it's understanding how those things are breaking through, or understanding the relative merits of the individual platforms that we look at, or the up-and-comers, not many of those, but there are some, the up-and-comers in platforms, or indeed in software, or in hardware companies. So it's really, the fundamental point is they're two entirely different worlds. There's an old world, and there's a new world. And unfortunately, they get pushed together. And that's wrong, because you can't evaluate a new world coming. And this goes into, you know, theories of what creativity are. I mean, I despair at how the many people in our industry look with rose-tinted spectacles at the past. The system, the whole ecosystem has changed dramatically. It started to change in the mid-1990s with the breakthrough of the internet, and it is now speeding up. It's now moving at hyperspeed. The pandemic has speeded up the process. Nothing new, I think, as a result of the pandemic, but consumers, the media, enterprises have had to move far faster in the digital transformation process than they ever did before because of the pandemic. So it's moving at hyperspeed, and we have to move at hyperspeed with it. And the systems and the approaches and the theories that applied to the old world no longer apply in the new world. It's a very, very different world to operate in. It's a 24/7 always on world where agility is absolutely critical, where understanding of the digital ecosystem is absolutely critical, and where being efficient is absolutely critical, and being unified is critical. So you've got to have one firm, not a collection of firms who fight against one another. You've got to have, you know, you've got to have what others term the power of one, or one Dentsu, or one WPP, or whatever it happens to be. You have to create one firm.
So I want to focus on two things you said. So you was it the Warren Buffett quote that you said
Royalty on the growth of globalization.
No, you have to explain something simple. You've got to be able to do it easily on one sheet of paper.
Okay.
But then you also get a spinning gold coin for being the first person to mention the metaverse on this podcast. So I'm eyes wide open, and I'm learning what the metaverse is. I think I've got my head around it, but can you give me a Warren Buffett one page explanation
we're going to live in unreal worlds. We're going to live in virtual worlds. So we conducted our management meeting last week using the Oculus headsets, and you can get a super duper headset at an even greater price, well, a more expensive price, which is, I think, delivers a really, really excellent experience. I mean, and the technology and the headsets they're using at the moment, which are commonly available,
Why is that different? That's Second Life in VR. That's Facebook Rooms or whatever it was called.
Yes, but technology has moved on hugely, Tom, and to enable us to exchange information, to talk to one another, to use content in a totally different way. I mean, this will be, I think, extremely important. I mean, there's a way to go in terms of developing the technology, but it will be extremely important in the way that we operate. And the pandemic, again, you know, has highlighted the opportunities for people to start to talk to one another, not just by playing games in virtual reality, but starting to do things, meetings as we did last week, and events in a way that we never were able to do it before.
Tell me about those meetings. What were you getting? What kind of fidelity were you receiving in terms of that's better than a video call? Like, I'm slightly dubious. Help me understand what it was like.
We were in a 360 degree experience. It wasn't me looking. Well, at the moment, I'm looking at just a green tea. Actually, it's a white tea on a green background, and I'm looking at the S4 cartoon. In this experience, I and my colleagues were sitting around. Actually, in that case, we're sitting around the meeting table, talking to one another. We could, wave at one another. We could blink at one another. We could move our bodies. I mean, all of these things. I mean, it was a sort of real world experience, but in a virtual form. So we were, it was almost like Beam Me Down, Scotty. I mean,
was it better? What I want to know.
It's not perfect yet, but it's getting there. So I remember, I think it was 2014 or thereabouts, John Chambers at Cisco used to run a CEO-CIO conference. So the CEOs and CIOs would get together in Kiowa Island. And I actually spoke to somebody at Cisco recently about this because I thought I was dreaming this, but I am sure in around 2014, when they bought WebEx, we walked into a conference room in Kiowa Island, and there was like a hologram in the middle of the room. And there was somebody in the hologram, picture of somebody. It looked like it was 360 degree. And you could, if I remember rightly, you could walk around it. And this was beamed down from New York or wherever it was. And I said to the guy from Cisco I had met recently, was I dreaming or did I really see that? And this was like Beam Me Down, Scotty. So the answer to your question is we're going to be able to communicate with one another in forms, in very efficient digital forms that will reduce the necessity for travel, you know, in order to meet people. And I'm not saying that's not important, that, you know, face-to-face, eye-to-eye contact and whatever is not important. Of course it is. I'm saying that historically we've wasted a lot of time and expense in doing things that we really didn't have to do, that we could execute much more efficiently in a digital world, or which will be able to be done in a virtual world. It's enormously effective, and the technology will continue to improve, so it will become more and more real. I mean, I got into a McLaren car and went at 330 miles an hour, I think it was, in the film, in virtual reality. You know, we stream for the NBA. I think we're now into our third season. We're streaming in virtual reality at NBA games. I think we did 16 last year. I think we're going to do 26 this year, using Verizon's network and using the Oculus Facebook technology. So these things, you know, are starting to have a significant impact on what people are doing and how they're doing it.
So if a marketer is listening to this and they may be in the real world, in the analog world, as you say, in the no growth or slow growth world, and they're hearing your description of the metaverse and these technologies available, what would you say are the steps that a marketer needs to take to make sure they're ready for something like the metaverse, whether or not that odd expression?
If it is two worlds, I mean, a lot of clients operate in the old world and are resistant to move into the new world. You know, so they're resistant to move from analog to digital and the new opportunities. And a lot of them have been caught out because they didn't move fast enough. I think in a 24/7 always on world, I think, you know, I'm using an analogy, really a political analogy, of using the line that Dominic Cummings used for Brexit, which is to take back control. I think client marketeers in a 24/7 always on world have to take back control. They surrendered too much control to agencies, outside parties, consultants after 2008 and the great financial crisis. It was very fashionable, you know, zero-based budgeting, which meant, you know, deconstructing your cost structure and then building it up again, became very, very popular. Was proven to be not as good as people thought it was, because it reduced brand spending and more importantly, reduced innovation spending. So that sort of become less important, but still focus on cost, focus on outsourcing, focus on procurement in a low growth world where there was very little inflation, very little pricing power. In a 24/7 always on world, you have to have control. And so I think that's critically important. I think following Google's decision on a cookie-less world and Apple's decision on IDFA, the importance of first-party data and linking first-party data, that's client-owned data, client data that where consumers have consented to its use, so getting over the privacy hurdle, using that data together with signals from the platforms becomes extremely important. You know, we have three models at S4, we have an embedded model where we actually put people into clients, they're on our payroll. We have an in-house model where we work with clients almost to do ourselves out of a job. And then we have the normal outsource model. It's different horses for different courses, and it depends on the dynamics of the industry. But generally, I think people should move, marketing departments should move to more of an embedded model with their agency partners, or to an in-house model. I think the sort of classical outsource model has passed its sell-by date. So taking back control, first party data, and then I would say emphasizing agility is critically important. You know, I mentioned that in the context of the way we go to market as faster, better, cheaper. Agility. Yeah, a lot of people talk about this, and a lot of people don't deliver it. I mean, one CMO of one of the big fan companies said to me, you know, you've got the new model at S4 Media Monks. You've got the new model. And I don't have to pay for all that, the useless overhead that I see or that is there. So, you know, coming up with a new model, and then another CCO of one of the big tech companies said, we're building, very interested in what we're doing, because we're building a network from the bottom up, meaning that we're focusing on the production side of the business, which is the core of it. You know, a lot of people dismissive historically of Media Monks, they say, oh, well, they're just a production shop. That's nonsense. What they specialize in is producing the product that we produce, which is the creative product. That's what they produce. And what this chief creative officer basically was saying was that we're starting in that area and building from there. And that's what the new network is about. The old networks, you know, what I said, there's the siloed organizations, but on top of that, even within the silos, you have silos. You have strategic planners, you have suits or account handlers, you have the creative department. I mean, it becomes overly complex. And coming back to what I said is the best advice, you know, have a simple vision and execute it with the best possible structure. I think that's critically important. So I think those are the issues: agility, first party data, combining that with the signals and taking back control. Those three things, I think, are what marketers should focus on.
Well, fantastic advice and a great way to finish the podcast. So, Martin, thank you so much for your
time. Thank you very much, Tom. Enjoyed it. Good luck. Good luck with another 160 or whatever it is you're going to do.
Thank you. Hi. Just before you go, I'd really appreciate it if you could take the time to write a review of the Shiny New Object podcast on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, whatever it's called these days, or whichever podcast provider you use. We're an indie podcast, so it would go a long way for us if you could just share the word and give us a bit of a support on those channels. That'd just be fantastic. If you haven't got time, that's also cool. And yeah, if you could tell your colleagues about the podcast, and also, if possible, don't forget to subscribe. And I'd love to hear your feedback. If you'd like to speak on the podcast or be a guest, or you think I'm asking the wrong questions, anything, I'd be super interested to hear what you think. So please email me at tom@automatedcreative.net. That's T-O-M at, I'm not going to bother spelling it. Anyway, you'll work it out. Thanks so much.